Okay, everybody, we're back. You're listening to It's All About Food here on a chilly November 5th, 2013. And now to part two of our program. I'm going to introduce my next guest. Mark Beekhoff is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He has worked alongside leading writers and activists, including Jane Goodall, Peter Singer, and PETA co-founder Ingrid Newkirk. He lives in Boulder, Colorado. That's a very, very, very brief bio because this man has done many amazing things and written many great books and so much more. Welcome to It's All About Food, Mark.
It's great to be here, Karen. Thanks for having me again.
Yes, thank you so much. I just finished reading Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed.
Yeah.
And I was very excited to find out about it because I did not know that you were writing a blog column on Psychology Today.
Right.
And it's, well, on one hand, I'm really glad I found it. On the other hand, my book list has just grown by like a thousand things I now have to read.
Yes. Well, there's a lot out there, but I'm hoping you'll enjoy what I write.
Yeah, so that's what's exciting. There's a lot out there about animals, and I believe that, we have this horrible history as humans, I think, where we've done so many terrible things. We do a lot of wonderful things, but we've done some terrible things. And a lot of it just comes from ignorance and not really understanding what we're doing. And we treat fellow humans too often without respect or integrity. And we certainly do that with other non-human animals.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. We just need to learn, once we open our minds to what's really in front of us, we're just going to soar. And I believe that a lot of the work that you highlight in this book is the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, really what the book is all about, I've written about 500 essays for Psych Today, and there's a little more than 100 in there. What I really try to cover are the new and exciting discoveries, like mice displaying empathy, chickens and rats displaying empathy. We've just learned recently that a fish actually uses their head to indicate where there's food. Mm. And in ethology, or the study of animal behavior, we call that referential communication. And it used to be thought that only humans did it, and we know other animals do it now. And so, one thing after another in terms of animal consciousness, animal sentience, animal cognition, animal emotions, and it's just incredible what we're learning about other animals. So that's what I try to do in these essays, just make them digestible to people and, don't compromise on the science, but really present them so that non-scientists can read them.
Humans have had this opinion, I guess I have to include myself in this group. I like to think sometimes that maybe I'm part alien, but maybe not. Anyway, humans have believed that we are the most amazing of all the species, the most superior, the most intelligent, and it's really not a good idea to think that way. And once we get humble and realize that all species have something to offer to this world.
Right. I mean, the bottom line, I say it in the book, is that animals, including human animals, need to do what they need to do to be card-carrying members of their species. And so what that really means is that we do amazing things. And you're right, as you said in the beginning, we do some pretty nasty things, but we do a lot of wonderful things, and so do other animals. And so, we can't fly like birds or hear ultrasound or very low frequency sounds like elephants and whales, but we can do other things. And so really what we're learning in the study of behavior, when you really look at it from a biological point of view, is that it doesn't get us anywhere to say, oh, dogs are more intelligent than cats or cats are more intelligent than bees. Really what we have to look at is how do they do as members of their own species? And that's what I think is definitely, the the main, one of the main messages of my book.
From a psychological point of view, and I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or any of that, but I do read a lot. A lot of what we do as humans is out of fear. We
yes.
fear a lot of things, and we do unfortunate things because of that. And when I was reading this book, I kept thinking about the opinions or the feelings that we had towards other humans when people came from Europe to the United States and encountered the Indians. They just thought the Indians were they were not as civilized. They were barbaric. They just didn't understand their culture, their language, their way of living, and we looked down on them.
Right, and that's exactly what other what people do about other animals.
Exactly.
You know, if you don't understand other non-human or human animals, you don't appreciate them, and they become second-class citizens. And then we start assigning value, because when we don't understand something, we fear it. And that's actually a very cogent point, because when we fear other animals, what happens is we treat them differently, and we usually treat them and take advantage of them in order to dominate them. And so one of the things that I try to point out is that, well, sure, we should fear other animals. They can be dangerous. I've had many close encounters with cougars, mountain lions, and black bears. And some of my friends say, oh, that's really cool. And I go, no, there was nothing cool about it at all. but I met them. I'm okay. And where I live, I have these animals, you know, in my neighborhood. And so I just have to take care and respect the fact that I moved into their house, that I like to say I redecorated nature. And so, you know, I really think that what we're learning, that as we learn more and more about animals, that fear will really go, you know, disappear.
There's so many different little tidbits in here, and if you read each article, there's often a link or a recommended reading to learn more about each item. And a few things that stood out for me, I'll just mention them briefly. You mentioned a study about how people who live with cats have a lower risk of heart disease or heart attacks. You had a fascinating article about what's in urine and what fascinates dogs about urine, because they're so sensitive to smell and all the things that they learn from
mm-hmm.
it. And I just want to stop there for a minute. That was so fascinating. There's just so much information in urine
yes.
that dogs take advantage of.
Yes, and so do other animals, you know, like rodents, elephants. And right, and that gets back to the point we were making before, is that animals, you know, do what they need to do to be members of their species. And so if you're a cud-carrying dog, you better have a really good sniffer. And
we look at that and we say, oh, that's gross. They're sticking their nose and it's dirty. But they're decoding. And we could take advantage of that if we could understand what was going on.
Oh, right. I mean, as we learn, you know, about the different sensory modes that animals use, we could use that not only to, you know, learn about them, but also to just basically come to understand how we can treat them better and what they need. And so we all know, you know, if you live with dogs, that certain high-frequency sounds really freak them out. Certain odors really are stressful to them. Birds, you know, male birds especially sing, and when they hear certain songs or certain, you know, noise in their environment, it really can bother them. So I think that as we learn more and more about the natural behavior of these animals, it'll really translate over to how we treat them, how we house them, how we walk them, how we view them. And so, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer that as we're learning more about their behavior, we really, really will also learn more about ourselves. And that's another message in the book of how when we do good things for animals and Earth, we feel good. And when we harm other animals, we really suffer the indignities.
Ah, that reminded me. There, you have many different articles early in the book about dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the unconditional love that dogs give humans. And we most of us know this, but what I loved was you wrote that their giving unconditional love brings love back to them. Their human guardians feel tremendous love for their dog, and that made me think that's all the more reason for all of us to love unconditionally as many people as we possibly can, to put out love, because love comes back.
Yes. A few times in the book, I have the little phrase that compassion begets compassion, and, you know, basically the opposite, violence begets violence. And I was just reading an interesting story about how people who feel really good about themselves tend to display more empathy and compassion for others. And I always tell people, you don't have to worry about running out of compassion credits. I mean, you really don't, because they'll come back at you. And when you get more compassion coming at you, then what happens is you basically then can give it to others. So it's a win-win situation.
So when humans talk about how superior we are, some of the things that are listed are the fact that we use tools and we communicate. And we're learning more about how other animals use tools, oops, and other animals have their own language and way of communicating.
Right. I mean, we know that there's a species of bird called New Caledonian crows who live in New Caledonia, and they fashion and use tools that are more sophisticated than tools that chimpanzees make. And we know that prairie dogs have an incredible language. They basically can use sentences. They have very, very distinct messages they send to one another concerning, like, when a human comes, you know, what they're wearing, who they are, when other animals such as predators are around. And, you know, once again, we're not unique that way. I mean, there's no, you know, animals who speak English or French or any of the human languages, but there's lots of animals that do really amazing things that we can't do, and do amazing things that they can't do.
One of the things you mentioned a number of times in the book, and this was very moving to me. Most of the book was just like, oh my goodness, there's just so much incredible stuff going on out there we're not paying attention to. We're just too busy focused on our phones. is that different animals grieve and mourn their loss and actually have a version of a funeral.
Yes, I've seen it in magpie birds. Mm-hmm. I've seen it in foxes. You know, people, it's very commonly observed in elephants, and there's been some recent wonderful videos on the web of chimpanzees. Yeah, I mean, the major point there is that animals recognize a loss. We're not saying they have the same concept of death that we do, because it doesn't seem that they do. But they recognize a loss, and they show respect to the corpse, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, God, we're just seeing it across species now, lots of mammals and birds. And so, and it's really just indicating that the animals know something has happened. It's not, it doesn't get us anywhere to say bad or good. Of course, a death in, you know, in humans, we would, you know, cash out as bad. But I'm not sure they do that. I think what they do is they notice that something is going on that hadn't gone on before. They may do it because of an odor. Some people have suggested that, you know, the lack of a sound. We don't really know the mechanism. Mm. But the fact is, they know, if you will, when another animal is really in pain or suffering, and they change their behavior accordingly. And it's just incredible to see. I just got a video from a couple in Canada who saw a, you know, basically a funeral ritual in magpies, and that was one of the first ones that I reported years ago. And, you know, the birds stand around, they brought pine needles and twigs, laid them around the body of the dead magpie, and then they all stood around the corpse and almost imperceptibly bowed their head forward. And I was with a friend of mine named Rod, who doesn't study animal behavior, And he was incredulous. I mean, we were both mesmerized. And as we rode off on our bikes, he said, "Wow, did you see that? Oh, I guess you see that every day." I had never seen it. But it was good that Rod was there. Not that I would embellish it or falsify it. It was good that Rod was there. He was moved as much as I was.
So anybody would be.
Mm-hmm. Once again, you know, if we do something, then it's possible that they, other animals, do it, and we just need to keep the door open. I mean, the last 10 years has been remarkable in terms of what we've learned about other animals, and my God, I think the next 10 years is just going to be unbelievably rich in what we learn.
You've got a number of articles about zoos. How
Yes.
do you really feel about zoos?
Well, you know, I'm very honest to say I wish zoos would go away, but they're not going to go away anytime soon. I mean, there's practical matters. For example, you know, where are all the animals going to go? So my take on zoos is that we should give the animals who are living there, and they're basically forced to live there, the very best lives we can. And we need to really recognize, you know, that we can always do better. I think we need to get rid of some zoos, even some zoos that are accredited by the AZA, because they just don't have very high standards. And there's thousands of roadside zoos that have no standards at all. You know, they don't have to answer to anybody. And so, you know, I think that's what we need to do, and slowly but surely phase out the zoos and send the animals to sanctuaries. And in fact, Costa Rica just closed its two zoos and will be sending all of the animals to rehab sanctuaries.
Woo! Yes, I heard that. And
yes.
That is so, so inspiring.
I mean, there's just a lot that can be done. And I think that, you know, when you take a dose of reality, zoos are not going to close overnight. But I really do think that there's quite a bit that we can do, and believe it, really, people are doing it. You know, more than six American zoos have phased out their elephant exhibits. I mean, elephants simply don't belong in zoos. So if you want to look at it that way, you can begin to sort of try to figure out which animals do better than others. But large animals like elephants don't do well in zoos, and major zoos are phasing out their elephant exhibits.
There's one article you have talking about killer whales and how at one exhibit there are people that are responsible for actually playing with Tilly's Willy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I just find so unbelievable, not just in a place like this, but we find it in animal agriculture, where there are people that are highly educated, they have great credentials, and they're responsible for raping these animals or getting sperm out of them or inseminating the females. And whoever came up with this stuff?
Well, you're right. I mean, that was the Tilikum is the male killer whale at SeaWorld who killed some people years ago and then killed a keeper I think 2 years ago. And there's a new documentary that's been showing all over, and CNN has been showing it, called Blackfish, which is really it's a superb, superb documentary, you know, about the ills of what happens at places like SeaWorld. The Tilly's Willy thing is just horrific, because what they do is they basically, you know, make the animal produce sperm, and then they use that sperm to make more whales and more whales who are going to live the rest of their lives in captivity and who will then be used to make more whales. And I call them whale mills. I mean, like puppy mills. And that's what they are. And so it's not surprising that a whale like Tilikum or Tilly gets really upset and, you know, harms or kills someone. It's a no-brainer that something like that is going to happen. And it's terribly sad. I mean, nobody's going around and saying, yeah, you know, look at this. This is what, you know, but we need to change our ways, Karen, really, really fast.
Yes. Now, of course, my passion is with food. This show is called It's All About Food. You have a section about animals and food.
Yep.
Now, I would want to believe that if we understood more about animals and understood their intelligence and understood that we are not superior, that we would be less likely to eat them.
Yes. Well, you know, I say in the book, and I always say when I give talks, that it's not a matter of what we eat, it's a matter of who we eat. And the reason I point that out is most food animals, or many food animals, are formerly sentient beings. And so I'm not saying that to be cute, and I'm not saying it to be antagonistic. But whenever I use that phrase and I talk to people, it's amazing how it changes their attitudes. And I had an email from a woman in Vienna, Austria, where I gave a talk 2 years ago, and I just mentioned, you know, it's who we eat, not what we eat, these ascension beings who wind up at the end of a fork or on a, you know, a platter of pain. And apparently six people who heard my lecture slowly but surely became vegetarians. And
no.
Yeah, and it really pleased me, not because I'm, you know, putting a feather in my cap, but it pleased me that it really made a difference to them when they started thinking about who, not what.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I do. I'm very passionate about that because I think for health reasons and ethical reasons, the way we eat and the choices we make can really, really have an impact on the lives of animals.
It's time. And you actually said that humans aren't really that bad.
No.
That we're more good than bad.
We are far more good than bad. We really are. I know people will always point to the bad, but I think that's because blood cells. You know, I mean, I've tried to get some newspaper or magazine, you know, articles out about goodness and cooperation, and we're learning that. There's psychologist Dr. Keltner at the University of California in Berkeley who wrote a wonderful book called Born to Be Good. And my book, The Animal Manifesto, is very much along those lines. He's dealing with human animals. I'm dealing with non-human animals. And more research is showing that, in fact, we are inherently cooperative and good. I mean, think of all the people you know, and I really mean that. I wish people would do this. You know, it's only a very, very few people who are nasty.
Yeah, but they have so much power.
Power. No, exactly. And that's the point I try to make, Karen, is that they have power, and we should harness our basic goodness when dealing with others. You know, I've been involved in this movement called Compassionate Conservation, and another book I had come out this year was called Ignoring Nature No More. And Compassionate Conservation stresses that the lives of every individual matter, and that we are inherently kind, beneficent, empathic, cooperative, however you want to cash it out, and that we should harness that inherent goodness. And more research on humans is showing that that is the case. I'm so glad to discuss that with you because it really, really should move people to know that being nasty and being warlike is not natural.
War is not natural. And I think that's the best place to end because we're at the end of the half hour. Yeah, thank you. And I want to recommend not only do you want to pick up Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, but this psychologytoday.com/blog/animal-emotions is a great place. You could read the entries. They're short and very moving.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you, listeners. We will make a difference, I promise you.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you, Mark Beekhoff.
Thank you, Karen.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food. And have a delicious week.